Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
John Reinhart is passionate about his family, his sponsor kids, the food bank he started, and the churches he's planted. He was never all that passionate about selling photocopies, and there's more on that in a few moments' time. John is very passionate, however, about the lessons we can all learn from the compelling generosity of patrons who supported the world-changing ministries of everyone from Jesus through to modern-day preachers and teachers. He's hand-selected some of these stories for his book, Gospel Patrons. And when we welcomed John to Open House, we started, parochially perhaps, with the Australian connection to his ministry.
Yeah, so when I graduated from university, I worked in business for a few years, selling copiers. I felt like when I was selling to business leaders and owners, I wanted to talk to them more about Jesus than I did about their business or copy machines or anything like that. So I ended up going back to seminary and studying the Bible for 4 years. Got a Master of Divinity degree from a school in California. And after that, my wife and I said, let's travel. We don't have kids yet. We don't own a home, don't have a mortgage. Let's see the world, become global Christians. And I wind up in Sydney having coffee with a businessman here.
It's responsible for a dynamic shift in your worldview, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I sat down with them and our mutual friend in India had said, ask him about something called gospel patronage. And I said, I don't even know what that is. And he said, yeah, don't worry, just ask him. Okay, I took it on faith. He's a friend of mine. So we sat down and I said to this man, what's gospel patronage? He said, whenever God has raised up great preachers, well-known spiritual leaders, pastors, missionaries in history to really move things forward, he also, if we look more closely at history, raises up patrons. These are people who come behind them. They're quietly in the shadows, but they're very important individuals. They fund them. They resource them. They come alongside them to help them do what God's called them to do. I was astounded. Here I'd studied business, I'd been to a Christian university, I'd studied theology, I'd heard biographies of missionaries, pastors, Bible translators, but I'd never heard a biography of a Christian businessman. So I said, give me an example. What are you talking about? He said, for example, 500 years ago, there was no English Bible. It simply did not exist. It had been in Latin for 1,000 years. The problem was, over time, nobody in England could read Latin. I mean, the priests, the academic people, but the common people had no conception of it, which meant any time they wanted to hear God's voice, it was coming through a filter. They could go to church, wouldn't understand it. And God, in the 1500s, raised up this man named William Tyndale. Tyndale said, I want to bring my nation an English Bible. The other problem was it was illegal. 100 years prior, the English Bible had been outlawed. It's crazy to think, but that's actually what it was.
You could lose your life for having one, couldn't
absolutely,
you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And so Tyndale has this burden for his nation, this dream of what he wants to do, but not the means to do it. Until he bumps into a wealthy businessman named Humphrey Monmouth. Nobody remembers Humphrey Monmouth. His name is just, we can't even pronounce it barely anymore, right? But this wealthy cloth merchant happens to hear Tyndale preach in London on Fleet Street and says, Tyndale, I've heard God's given you a job to do. It's time you get to work. Come, live at my house. I'll protect you. I'll provide for you. Get to work. So Tyndale is furiously translating the Bible for 6 months, night and day, living with a wealthy businessman and his family. Well, within 6 months, he heads off to the European continent. Printing is still new technology, and so all the best printers were in the European continent. And his merchant friend, this businessman, uses his merchant ships to get Tyndale to Europe. When he's done, the merchant again is called upon to use his merchant ships to smuggle the first 3,000 New Testaments, English New Testaments, back into England. These are contraband, illegal books. The merchant didn't just write a check. He's now using his business resources, wrapping these Bibles in cloth, dropping them in barrels of oil and barrels of wine in these watertight boxes. And the first 3,000 English Bibles find their way into England and begin to launch this English Reformation. And behind it all was a wealthy businessman named Humphrey Monmouth, who nobody remembers.
John, this is biblical. How is it we've missed this headline for so long?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've read through the Bible several times. I mean, I've read through especially the New Testament more often, but we tend to just focus on the theological chapters and read over the names because the names feel irrelevant. But when we look more closely, we see it is biblical. I mean, Phoebe is listed in Romans 16. Now, we've heard the name Phoebe perhaps, but we don't pay attention to what Paul says. Romans 16, 1 and 2, Paul says, greet Phoebe in a way that's worthy of the saints because she's been a patron of many and of myself as well. So Paul was generously funded and supported by a woman named Phoebe. But even more than that, even more compelling than Paul having a patron to me, is that Jesus Christ had gospel patrons funding his ministry. We just don't even think about how he funded 3 years of a preaching tour from town to town, city to city. Yeah. And I guess we kind of assume that it was a miracle meal of like fishes and loaves being multiplied every day for lunch, but it actually wasn't. Luke chapter 8 tells us there were three women who gave generously out of their means to provide for Jesus and his disciples. It even gives us their names, Mary, Joanna, and Susanna. They were patrons of Jesus's ministry, which, by the way, is a very, very good investment of your wealth. If you could invest in anything, what's the return on that to patron Jesus's ministry?
And just as a side note, John, there's something incredibly countercultural to a patriarchal society like Christ's, that it's three women serving as patrons.
I think this is a really encouraging message for women to say, this is not just a man's domain or a man's game here. Actually, you know, so many of the patrons in Scripture were women. In my book, there's one example who's a woman, two that are men. But the one woman example, she's Lady Huntington from the 18th century. She basically patroned and funded George Whitefield, the greatest evangelist of the 18th century, who led to the evangelical awakening in England and the Great Awakening in America. Behind it was a wealthy, aristocratic, fiery, Bible-believing. She enjoyed a pinch of snuff. She rubbed shoulders with royalty, and she loved her Bible and got behind George Whitefield. This is a woman. This is a powerful, forceful, dominant, generous, humble woman.
What does a healthy patronage look like?
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, I was not just writing about this, I got to experience it at the same time. Much like William Tyndale, I was in this position where after hearing these stories in Sydney from this businessman who's a friend of mine now, I was gripped that this book has to get out there. I just sent him an email and said, I can't wait 10 years. Let's do something to get these stories out to the world. But I needed I just finished seminary. I needed an income to do it. And I knew I wasn't smart enough or good enough to just do it 2 hours a night or 2 hours in the morning on the side and really dig into history like this. So for 8 months, I was slugging away, beginning the research, praying and seeking God to provide for me to do this book project. And it was a stressful time. It was a faith-building time. But a man came alongside me and said, you know, I'd love to be able to say when God, you know, approaches me one day, what'd you do with what I gave you? He said, I'd love to be able to say I got the English Bible into the world like Humphrey Monmouth and Tyndale, but that one's already taken. So what if we got your book into the world?
No pressure there, John.
Yeah, right. What if we got your book into the world? He said, you know, we'll consider you like a missionary and we'll come alongside you, my wife and I, and support you and fund you to get this book into the world and see what God might do with it. So at the very same time that I'm writing about this from a biblical perspective and a historical perspective, I'm receiving patronage. And it was a powerful experience to see that my gospel patron didn't act like my boss. He didn't check in on me in a way that, you know, is expecting progress reports and tasks to be completed.
Or editorial control.
No, not at all. Not at all. He said, I can't write that book. That's not my domain. I'm a good businessman. That's what I do. You do what you do. I just want to get behind you. So he would offer input to the scope of it and the publishing and the printing aspect of it. But on the whole, he was very humble, very open-handed with the whole thing. And that was a big stewardship for me to trust and to walk before God to say, let me do the best that I can. And this is a dynamic partnership. You know, by the end, he wasn't just giving me money and advice, but his wife had even said to me, you know, he really trusts you. And if anything good or bad, big or small happened in his life, he told his wife, I'd be the first person he'd call. That's a lot more than just a financial transactional arrangement. Yeah. You know, we became great, great friends. And so patrons, this gospel patrons partnership is a real partnership of giving and receiving from both sides.
John, with so much need in our world, how do we divine which cause to patron?
That's a great question. I don't think there's a formula that I can give you for that. It is a prayerful walking with God, asking him, hey, you've given me X amount of resources, X amount of dollars this year. I want to be generous. I want to stretch myself each year to be more generous than I was in the past. But I think that there are a couple questions you do need to ask up front. Number one, what does the person or organization I'm supporting believe? So the gospel comes first in the title, Gospel Patrons. Gospel just means good news. What news is that organization promoting? Every advertisement, every company, they're promoting some sort of good news. So you want to say, what good news is it? What do they believe? And then is that aligned with what I believe, what the Bible says, and how can I get behind that? I think there's a lot of organizations that are about good causes, that are about human welfare. I'm into that. Started a food bank at my church. I've adopted two orphans from Africa. But at the end of the day, there's eternal ultimate needs. And I think we need to think in that sort of long-term priority that a person's greatest potential suffering is not sickness. It's not poverty. It's not ignorance. It's hell. And in a day where it's unpopular to believe in hell and lots of people want to dismiss it, the Bible's really clear. Jesus is really clear. Hell is a person's greatest potential suffering. On the other side, the greatest potential blessing and joy in a person's life is to be with God forever in heaven. Psalm 16 says that in your presence, there's fullness of joy, and at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. So if you want to love someone ultimately, you want to meet their most ultimate need, which is really an eternal need, and their choice between heaven and hell and what God will do to enter in and save them from that. You want to come alongside people and organizations that are aiming at that.
Is patronage only the domain of the wealthy?
Not at all. Good question. I'm really glad you asked that. I think it's easy for a business leader to resonate with the message because they're getting asked for money all the time, and they probably have considerable resources to be generous with. But we see that Jesus actually praises the woman, you know, for putting in her two copper coins, and that was all that she had to live on in Luke chapter 21. He's not just pleased with big checks and big numbers. What I love in those parables where Jesus says if someone was given 10 talents, some 5, some 2, some 1, is when we apply that to our own lives, we actually don't know how many talents we've been given. I would really break down gospel patrons or gospel patronage, as you say here in Australia, into three components. Number one is resourcing. Resourcing can look like finances, funding, money, you know, asking for those things. But you can also resource and be a gospel patron in a variety of ways. We talked about the story of William Tyndale and him, his patron using his merchant ships to smuggle these Bibles back into England. Well, that wasn't his money, but it was certainly a resource and an essential resource to get the job done. So even for a building campaign for a local church, there might be people who come along in the church who will say, hey, I'm a construction manager. I could oversee the project and I'll do it pro bono. That's more valuable sometimes than someone giving money. Or there's an IT guy at a church or an organization. He just says, you know, just let me take care of that for you. I can't give a lot of money, but I can give expertise. I can give my influence. I can, you know, lend an ear. That's really valuable too. And so I think the first component of a gospel patron is that they are generously resourcing, whatever that means for them. Number two, they're personally involved. They don't just sit back, write a check, you know, keep their distance. That's comfortable. I'm thankful that God didn't do that. Galatians 2:20 says that Jesus loved us and gave himself for us. The most costly thing you can give is not your money. It's not your time. It's yourself. How do I get involved in what's going on? So gospel patrons, they give themselves. They're personally involved and engaged and invested to the project. And lastly, the third component is that it's for the spread of the gospel.
When you were putting your book, Gospel Patrons, together, John, who was the patron that you felt the greatest affinity with?
That is a tough question. The stories do have pretty powerful figures in them. I think one of the guys I loved was this man named John Thornton. He was the wealthiest merchant in all of England in the 18th century, did trade with Russia, multiple investments, received a huge inheritance, and then just skyrocketed from there. But he was amazingly humble. And I'm not saying I'm amazingly humble, right? But he had this sense of, though he could have all the privileges of wealth and society, he was willing to say, that's not my main goal. My main mission is my master's mission. It's his business that I'm about. And so he came alongside rural country pastors, often providing for their salaries for years on end. One of those men, the most prominent of whom, was named John Newton. John Newton was, you know, a man who nobody wanted to be a pastor. He had had too checkered of a past. His sins were too dark. He'd been involved in the slave trade in multiple ways. And, after his radical conversion, he said, the only thing I want to do is preach the gospel now. But everyone said, hey, you are not the pastor type. You do not fit our mold. So for 5 years, John Newton got another job working in the shipping industry, teaching himself Greek and Hebrew and studying the Bible and theology, saying, okay, God, I'm just going to get ready. And it was a gospel patron who came alongside him and kind of used his influence now, not his wealth, but his influence to get him into this little country church in Olney, 60 miles north of London. Newton's conversion story became famous and so well known in England that this man named John Thornton, a wealthy merchant, rides his horse 60 miles from London to Olney to hear Newton preach in this little country church. And after hearing him preach, he said, "Newton, I know your salary is only £40 a year. I'm going to come alongside you and give you £200 a year for your ministry expenses. Be hospitable. Be generous. Use it for God's kingdom. And if there's anything else you need, just let me know." Who does that, right? Yeah. And he didn't just do that for 1 year. He did that for 15 consecutive years and didn't even stop there. After 15 years of this patronage relationship, this strategic pulpit opened up in London. Thornton bought the rights to it, essentially, and moved Newton into the heart of the business district of London, said, "This man's got a great voice. You know, he's ready to preach. He's got all, you know, this great track record. I've got to get him a broader influence." That was one of the most strategic moves in history in the 18th century, because Newton then comes into contact with Wilberforce, you know, basically mentors him through his conversion, keeps him in Parliament, and walks him through, as a pastor, how to abolish the slave trade. He, with his own slavery experience in the background. I mean, it's just astounding that behind it all was this merchant businessman who history has forgotten named John Thornton.
John, these stories have left me giddy almost with anticipation as to what it is that is next in our ministries. We want to wish you all the best in yours, and thank you for coming by.
Thank you. I'd love to just say that my book is available on Matthias Media's website. You can also get the Kindle version on Amazon, and my personal website is www.johnwreinhardt.com.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.